you know, I think it's just good to have a document or something to keep your business direction front of mind and in check.
Yeah.
But whether that's for everyone or not, don't know.
Hello and welcome to the very first Design Principles podcast. I'm your host, Ben Sutherland.
And I'm Sam Brown.
And I'm Gerard Dombrowski.
Seeing as it's the very first episode, we thought it would be cool to maybe have a chat about how we came about starting our own architecture firms and maybe some of the pros and cons on how the process has gone for us and where we're at now. So thought that'd be a good way to kick things off. Sam, do you want to have a crack?
Yeah, man, let's crack it. So where did I start? Started my journey straight out of architecture school, joined a firm in Wellington called Foster Melville Architects. Kind of hung about there for about 6 years until my wife and I decided to take a year's trip overseas, which was a pretty eye-opening experience. And then sort of came back from that with a different view on the world and a different approach to architecture, and it didn't align with what my previous practice was doing, so I thought I'd start my own thing and jumped in, haven't looked back. I started by myself, but a year in I brought on a business partner, Johnny Fletcher, and we've been Red Architects ever since.
Where'd you go overseas?
We're everywhere, man. We hit every continent except for Africa, something like 35 countries, lots of time in South America, Central America, all around Western and Middle Europe, Central Europe. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
That's awesome. How did that sort of change your thoughts on the whole shebang?
I think you just get a wider worldview. And I think for me in particular, it sort of shifted my focus, not necessarily my focus, but before I went overseas, I was just on this path of work. And then that trip overseas really opened my eyes, and I was like, I need to approach my professional career with a little bit more of a purpose, I think. So came back, and that's what sort of driven one of the core ethos of Red Architects, which is this sort of this architecture which engages with its environment, sustainability arc, and all that sort of thing. So what I was really exposed to traveling was what humankind, I guess, the impact that it's having on the world, and wanting to be able to sort of leave my mark and make it a better place for ourselves and our generations to come.
Yeah. Was that like in a, like seeing historic building sort of context as well as like general misuse of resources, rubbish, et cetera?
Probably more misuse of resources, and also just how really prominent natural landscapes and forms and things like glacial recession and things like that, that is what probably influenced me more than the actual built environment, I'd say. It was more the natural environment. So it was pretty cool seeing, obviously, architecture internationally, but I think that had less of an impact on me than the environments that we explored.
Nice. It's always funny, especially places like Europe, going over there, experiencing the architecture, how sort of the longevity of it all, and then coming back to little old New Zealand and seeing how new everything is. And I don't know,
we just haven't been around long enough. We'll get there one day.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah,
those nice minimum 50-year, you know, building code houses, they'll be around forever, mate.
<That's great. laughs>
So how'd the process go for you? Do you think it went quite smooth, or are there things that you'd kind of change or improve? Or
it's a steep learning curve, eh? But I sort of tackled it. Talked to a lot of people in the build up to doing it, a lot of peers that had done the same thing, and sort of took their pros and cons and tried to iron out any of the questions before I kicked off. I didn't want to sort of start not knowing what I was doing and then find my feet midway through. And that proved to be a really successful approach. But there's definitely learning curves, and you know, it's a great time to start a business when the market's in an upturn. But a couple of years in, when there's a heavy old recession, it sort of means you take a look at things a little bit more closely. And I think, you know, a big learning from that is having a really strong business plan and referring to it constantly and updating it is critical. And that's something that we probably haven't done enough of, but looking to do a bit more in the future.
Interesting. I must always help having an in-house financial advisor as well.
Yeah, that helps. It certainly helps. I must admit, being able to sit back and focus on the architectural side of things and not have to worry about the financial side of things is certainly a benefit. So for listeners out there, I'm fortunate enough that my wife is in finance and she tackles all of the invoicing and the money side of the business. So I don't have to worry about that, which is nice.
It's interesting that you put such precedent on the or hierarchy on the business plan, though. I definitely did one, but I don't know. Is it actually that helpful? Like, what do you find it useful for?
I think it provides a framework for what your business direction is. Like, there's a reason why we all started our own things, right? And we'll get to the reasons why you guys started yours in a minute. Yeah. But without that written down sort of constant reminder of why you're here every day, you can sort of not necessarily lose your way, but your path can meander quite a bit. And it's good, not that meandering is a bad thing, but it's good towards, you know, come back and refer to why did I start this thing in the beginning? Has that changed? If it has, cool. Why? What's the direction from here? And if it hasn't, you know, have you drifted too far from the course? You know, did you start this whole thing with this idea of maybe providing architecture to all, and all of a sudden all you're doing is, you know, 5 million plus houses? You go, oh shit, well, I've sort of lost my way there. I've just become about the money.
Yep.
Is that a bad thing? Yes, no, maybe, don't know, revisit, restart, whatever. You know, I think it's just good to have a document or something to keep your business direction front of mind and in check.
Yep.
Yeah.
But whether that's for everyone or not, don't know.
So have you ran that right from the start? And like, was that like directly from your trip, that sort of misuse materials?
Or did you update it when Johnny Fletcher came on board?
Yeah,
he probably rewrote the whole thing for you.
We've been meaning to. It's funny, eh? Like, we haven't actually sat down. Like I said, like, we haven't actually sat down and completely redrafted that document, but it's still there, and we refer to it every so often. And it's not so much, it's more key objectives, you know. And I think one of the biggest things is, what's our ethos? You know, what's our brand, or what's our company tagline, for instance? And are we staying true to that? And I think it's good to have one of those things so you can constantly keep yourself accountable. So say your tagline is the best for the best or something along those lines.
Yep.
And you're providing, you know, high-end architecture for, you know, big money clients. Cool. Or if your tagline is something like ours, which is inhabit the environments in which we live in, or something along those lines. I can't remember what it is exactly off the top of my head. Yep. Then is the architecture that we're producing, is it achieving that? And it's good to kind of hold yourself to that. When Johnny came on board, we didn't necessarily rewrite it, but we do revisit it. And I think the biggest thing that we change is probably our goals. So we've got annual goals, 5-year goals, and then 10-year goals, and they're constantly changing as the business develops.
Yeah, nice. Do you update those goals just more every January kind of thing?
Yeah, we probably, like, I'm still away on leave.
Nice. The dream.
When I get back at the start of Feb, our plan is to sort of revisit that, and particularly annual goals, and sort of lay out what we want to achieve this year. But what about you guys? I mean, it's good having a business partner in that sense, because you've got somebody to sort of feed off and work with. But Gerard, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on it, being a solo practitioner.
Yeah, that sounding board sort of thing is like super valuable, and something I often run into. Like, I'll talk to my girlfriend or something, and after a while, it just like glazes over. It's like, there's only so often you can like bounce ideas off somebody until they get sick of it. But like, I've kind of run a similar thing with like writing a sort of document of intent and sort of like, I guess, goals and then like plan and strategy, I guess.
Do you want to kick us off with your background and that sort of your architecture?
Yeah, we'll back up the train a little. So for anybody who's listening, we all went to uni together, which is kind of a little
the good old days
on similar timelines.
And still friends.
Yeah, somehow.
Probably better friends now than we were at uni.
Yeah, right on.
Probably.
So I worked at a little office in Wellington for 3 years. But I've always had like an ambition to do my own work. And I think I'd probably take more of like the artistry route, where kind of my ambition is to create interesting architecture and sort of spaces that are maybe offer something to the world of design, and hopefully bring in something new, some new ideas.
Was that a concept that you brought on from the outset?
Yeah, I think so. I think when I was a real little kid, I wanted to be an inventor. I remember being real disappointed as a child that I couldn't think of any new ideas, like on the spot. And as I've gotten older, I've discovered that new ideas are like, they're weird things to find, but I don't know. It's definitely like an interesting pursuit within my work that I try to, and I have my own strategies and stuff around design process and stuff, which we can talk about another day. But it's, I mean, like
an example sitting right behind you are that giant steel banana.
Yeah. You know, little tricks upscaling an item turns it into a thing of design all of a sudden.
So Gerard, how do you find, I mean, architecture, although it's an artistic profession and pursuit, there's not as much room for artistry a lot of the time. Like, how do you go balancing that desire with what clients are looking for and things like that?
Super conversational. And I think often the expectation when you have like that discussion is we all have to live in fiberglass spaceships. But I think there's just little interesting ways that you can tackle problems. So I think a sort of a strategy within sort of my plan is that every job I take on kind of has to offer something interesting into my body of work. So that's how I critique often whether I take a project on or not. So I've definitely gone like the less is more sort of approach. Like a lot of architects, pretty inspired by our boy Peter Zumthor, who's done very little work in the grand scheme of things, like when you put him up against other architects. But the quality of work and the intentionality of it is pretty epic. Like, so he must have like quite a strict process for how he takes on jobs. So I've always been quite intentional about that. And then kind of, it wasn't meant to supplement, but to add as like a research base, I got into making furniture. During that first job, during that 3 years, I brought a shipping container and had it out in Lyle Bay, pretty much around the corner from where you are, Sam. And I'd sort of go there in my afternoons at Vosties.
Build some stuff.
Cycle on down and then just battle away till the later hours, sometimes early hours. So that was kind of feeding that itch of needing more design and more autonomy. Although, like, within that job, we were getting a huge amount of autonomy, which was super valuable. But for me, it's like the passion in the office wasn't quite working for me. And when you're at somebody else's job, you're working like 8 hours a day on sort of their dreams and goals. So eventually I went and did a brain rehab center with my friend Nick Ballara. We used to have some beers together, and he was like, I was telling him I was bored, and he was like, oh, you want to do a hospital? And I was like, oh, yeah, go on, probably do a donut. fast forward a few years, we've got a big building in Porirua with a courtyard in it. It's a square donut, but a donut nonetheless. So I was pretty stoked with, pretty appreciative of Nick for giving me that opportunity to do that project. And he was like, if you do this, that kind of gives you something to start a business with. Whilst it was run through his office, kind of the whole job was kind of contracted to me. And that kind of allowed me to pay my bills for 3 years, which was a really nice, easy way to crack
kick things off.
Yeah.
I was gonna ask you about that, because obviously this, you know, like you said, you've sort of afforded yourself the ability to pick and choose your clients, but obviously that doesn't necessarily pay the bills all the time. So by the sounds of things, you've sort of had that initial financial backing, but then also used your furniture design and stuff as supplementary income. Would that be right?
So within those 3 years, it was still predominantly like 95% architecture. And then I kind of had that dream of having like a workshop and office in the same space, so you could start to intermingle some of those ideas.
Bit of prototyping?
Yeah, bit of prototyping, mate. So I found this workshop, which is in an old wool shed up the back of Macra, up past the wind turbine, for fairly cheap. And then my friend Connor and I moved up there and fitted out a little shipping container and had our office up there, which was kind of the first stage of trying to really getting more into sort of object, furniture, art, and architecture at the same time. And it worked really well there because we had super low rent. So that's when I made a giant spoon and took like 6 months off and drove around the country with a big spoon. As you do. It's a super vague explanation for anybody listening. Yeah, so that's when it sort of really started to feather together a bit more. And then when I did that Piccolo project, I went up, that cheap rent allowed me to go up to Coromandel and build a little hut, which has done pretty well in terms of like press and social media and stuff. But then coming back, my rent was getting quadrupled. So.
Oh, yeah. Overhead's slowly creeping up.
Yeah,
not ideal. What's your ratio? Is it kind of to art to architecture?
It's probably 25% art, 25% furniture, 50% architecture, I'd say.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool, like pretty stoked to have that stuff. But it is like tough financially, but in my mind, we're still like building a foundation, building a brand, I guess. So I don't mind taking these hits at this stage in life if it means that when I'm an old boy, we sort of get a few more projects in the realm of the projects we want to do.
Yeah, because it must be, I can see like, you know, you're essentially starting two, potentially even three companies, one for the art, one for the architecture, and one for the furniture. So, yeah,
it must be podcast in interesting. There as well.
Yeah, podcast. Exactly. It must be hard to concentrate on three things at once. But yeah, I don't know, you seem to be doing a good job at it.
Yeah, it is pretty taxing though. I like, it's pretty like, there's always these decisions where you get to like an impasse where like Sam having the support of his wife who is so tied in, it's like a super valuable sounding board where you can sort of strategize, and then with a business partner, like three heads are better than one.
Yeah.
So
gives you someone to share the pain with as well.
Yeah, spreads that liability.
So at the moment, it's really nice to have a project with you, Ben, because it's just so much easier than your workhorse. So it's,
yeah. I don't know.
brings us to you then, Suds. What's your story? Tell us your history, mate.
Well, I'm actually on my second firm, I guess. The first one was Makers in Wellington there, which we started when we were still at university, which was quite fun. So that was four of us had a project on in Wellington post-earthquake project. And, yeah, that was like quite a interesting one. I did it for my thesis, and it was kind of meant to be the first digitally fabricated house in the country. And that went really well. We went down there and built it, and there was a lot of fun. Basically just got a bit of a client base after we finished that construction and built Makers off the back of it, really, and got quite a few, like a lot of interest, which was quite cool. And then I guess the idea then was to sort of do the design and build and bring them closer together to try and cut out a lot of that lost transfer of information that you kind of, or that segregation between what the architect is and what the builder is. So from there we started Makers Fabrication, and that was, I think that's, yeah, they're both still running today and still really successful, and learned so much from not only like the architecture firms and starting that, but also, you know, starting the prefabrication and construction company. So that was, yeah, that whole experience was interesting. It taught me a lot. I guess one of the key lessons was, I guess like if I was to go back, I would definitely question getting into it too soon. I think, like, especially like after hearing your story, Sam, it would have been quite cool to actually go back overseas and spend another couple of years experiencing different culture. Like when we were at uni, I did manage to slip away to Germany there for a year, but kind of not enough. And I didn't realize at the time how much like owning a company, because, you know, we were just kids and thought it'd be cool, how much it actually ties you down, kind of like, you know, locks you into one spot. And especially like this is well and truly pre-COVID. COVID has definitely changed a lot around flexibility. I think it's definitely possible to be an architect on the go a little bit more now than back then, but especially when you're kind of like a young entrepreneur trying to, figure things out as you go. I think it would have been good to maybe take a little bit of a break from university and experience the world a little bit more.
Experience is that key word there, though, eh? Like when you're starting your own architecture firm straight out of uni, what experience do you have? Not a lot.
And, yeah, none.
You know, it's an interesting one as well. Because how do you know, or how do you determine what your direction is going to be? You know, I think it takes us a long time, and I don't know about yourself, Gerard, and even you now, Ben, with a bit more experience behind you. But I still, even though, you know, a decade into this thing, in terms of working in architecture, the direction takes a long time to find. It takes a long time to find your design voice, what your aesthetic is, all of these things. And starting afresh, man, so hard to build from essentially no foundation and no base.
I guess.
So it's cool.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, it's cool. It's cool to hear that, you know, Makers Fab and Makers of Architecture are doing well, given, you know, that they started from that pretty raw beginning.
Absolutely. We thought we had a really clear, in fact, I know we had a really clear design direction then. And in fact, I think it was probably clearer then than it is now. It's taken us taken me all that time to get back to the clarity that we had then. And I guess that was like just built off the back of this whole thesis, all this research that we'd done about it. We were like, cool, we want to focus on, you know, digital fabrication. There's like this whole prefabrication. I know it's quite big now, but back then, this is, I don't know, 10 or 11 years ago now, it was actually kind of just coming in, into hitting New Zealand, really. Prefab NZ had just started. So there was a lot of stuff happening within that realm, which really made it so interesting for us. And going back to what Gerard was saying, kind of felt like we were, in hindsight, we were probably just reinventing the wheel, but it felt like we were doing a lot of innovation. And so that provided that clarity. It's like there's so many areas to improve in construction, especially with the use of digital technologies. And I guess what we just didn't realize and is like how long that the industry is just such a slow moving industry. Maybe it's just like how long it takes for the industry to kind of adapt and change and these technologies to improve over time. So I think we kind of ended up slowing down. I wouldn't say losing the innovation, but definitely slowing. It slowed down quite a bit. And that's when I think for me anyway, the design direction may have kind of, kind of slowed down at the same time.
And is that one of the reasons why you decided to move on? And sort of start to do your own thing.
I think it was it's just a bunch of reasons. And I think like another thing I realized, if I was to go back in time, I would do would really be to do some business courses pre company inception. I think not knowing and not only having to pick up the architecture side of things, but having to like learn about what businesses, I'm pretty sure it took us like 5 years just to figure out what a company is actually meant to be doing. And it sounds ridiculous, but you know, you're focused on all these other areas. You don't really concentrate on the business side of things. So I think like that kind of putting myself back to school and doing some business courses and that sort of thing has kind of helped me, reframe kind of what I want to get out of architecture these days. And I think in a lot of ways it's kind of helped, you know, with my architecture. I like to focus on, you know, the feasibility side of things a lot more as well as the architecture itself, which is quite different to, I guess, a lot of other architects. I really enjoy the financial side of architecture as well. So I guess like that's kind of the split is like that was kind of my interests were more on the developer kind of side.
Which, I was about to say, it sounds like you've taken like a more business-like approach to the design field, which is an interesting take. And it's sort of like we've got three different, I guess, avenues of architecture here, you know, Gerard with his artistic side, you Ben with your more business focused side, and then I guess me with the more holistic environmental side. It's quite cool to come at it from all these different angles.
Absolutely. But like I'm sure we can all agree on this, that it should not be one or the other. Like it's really about including it all, but it is good to kind of find your little niche.
That's the beautiful thing about our profession, though, right, is there's always space for anyone and everyone's approach, because no two clients are the same, no two projects are the same, no two sites are the same. So it gives us that opportunity to delve in if and when appropriate, which is cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you can stay in business, you must be doing something semi-okay.
You got to make it past that 5 years. So my new company... I've only been running it for a year now, or maybe not even that. So we're still extremely fresh.
You'll be fine, mate. You'll be fine.
Yeah, we'll be fine. Hopefully the market's on my side. We'll see.
It's on the upturn.
Yeah. There's so much meat in that maker's chatter, like all the work you've done over those years. That's like is a
huge and podcast about
just the setup of it.
Yeah, it's so valuable as well. Like, it was such a great experience and hard. Like, do not underestimate. It's the same with I can imagine you guys would 100% agree on this. Like, it is hard. It's a grind, you know. Owning your architecture practice is absolutely a grind, day in and day out. You've just got to, like, get in there, do what needs to be done. You're the firefighter, you know. You're the one that's got to go around and put out all the fires. And especially, you know, with makers, I'm not saying that they've got heaps of fires or anything, although there was a fire once. It's just like they had their staff, you know, when we were there, they had quite a few staff. So just having to, like, learn about, employee relationships and that sort of thing, like, it definitely takes things to a whole new level.
I mean, that's a good point to, I mean, that's a good, this is a good point to sort of, let's get a hot take, right? Like, if you guys were to give someone who's looking to start their own firm, whether it's in architecture, whether it's in anything, in just their own business, like, Gerard, what's your, what number one hot take for someone to take away starting their own thing?
I think the thing we all share is that initial naivety, and, like, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, I think. If you're going to jump into something, which
it helps to be naive,
as gnarly as this, it's sometimes better not to know the full picture. So,
yeah,
like,
absolutely. True.
I'm actually all for, like, the healthy naivety, because otherwise some people just wouldn't start. So I think the best thing is just to crack in, and, like, your maker's route, like, there's a huge amount of experience there that you have now. And, like, me and Sam working at other jobs, like, trying to pick up, trying to farm as much knowledge as we could during that time.
Mm.
But ultimately, you've got to press go at some point. And, I got that help of Nick to sort of blur my way in.
Yeah.
Which was quite
Ben, cool. What's your hot take?
Well, I have a different stance, but that's only because I guess it's more of, like, me as an individual. My tolerance for risk is quite low, so I have no problems kind of just diving in and giving it a go. After so many years of, like, startups and whatnot, you kind of learn to live off the smell of an oily rag, so it is what it is. I guess, like, mine would be more around, like, getting some sort of financial education marry finance someone in the financial industry. That always helps. I just think, like, learning the ins and outs of what a company is and what it should be doing and what you're actually there for, other than the architecture, because, you know, they really should go hand in hand. That's key. And then, yeah, just getting as much experience prior to diving in as possible, especially the key aspects. I think that's key.
Sure.
Yeah, what about you, Sam?
My quick hot take would be prepared to never shut off. I think that's the key one, is, like, when you start your own thing, there's no
weekends.
There's no chance. There's no weekends.
No 9 to 5.
There's no working overtime. There's no holidays. I mean, you've got
holidays, right?
exactly right. I mean, let's put it this way. You can afford yourself all of this stuff if you want it, and a lot of the time you do. But the thing is, you are going to always be thinking about your business. You're always going to be thinking about what's next, how to change things, how to make things better, staff, problems, successes, all of that stuff. It's just a constant back of your mind. So just be prepared to have the nag.
Yeah.
It's a great nag because it's your nag. It's not someone else's, but be prepared to have it.
And also, like, just being an architect kind of adds to that as well, though, because not only are you kind of obsessed with, you know, you've got these, you've got your architecture, your clients and your business, but also just, like, life in general. Like, architects just absolutely love designing every aspect of their life. So when you combine that with, like, business, you're like, okay, how can I make this epic? Like, how can I make it super clean and, you know, like, I don't know. I find that a lot. Think about it all the time.
We're all OCD to some level.
I think, like, I probably took that to the extreme for a while. just like all I did was work, and it kind of like maybe had some issues on my relationships at the time.
Yeah.
And then like you kind of sometimes you get to the stage of like burnout. So in the last year, I've kind of had to learn the opposite to like make sure I like relax a little bit and sort of unwind a little bit, give a little space to breathe.
But the nag's always there, though, right?
Oh, the nag lives on.
You just need to try and make it as fun as possible along the way, yeah. Though. Like, I, for example, this podcast, like, it's just fun. Like, it's just like, yes, it is business related, and we probably will think about it a lot. But it's a great opportunity for us to just like do all that interesting research that we all want to do anyway. But actually, like, transition that research into something useful. And just have a good conversation about some interesting architecture business related ins and outs, I guess.
Yeah.
Exactly. And hopefully people can get something from it. Yeah. You know, it's nice to give back as well.
Yeah.
It's a very take industry, so it's nice to give a bit of have a little bit of give as well.
It's good to give some insight. So a bit of meat. I think a lot of the podcasts I listen to, I'm like, when people discuss how they started their journey, you know, it's all like super straightforward and like, oh yeah, I got
Rosie.
This job, and then I got this
it
job.
It was great.
Then I was inundated and I
yeah.
never had trouble paying bills. Whereas
it's like, it's one or the other, right? It's like, oh, I've just been struggling to get work the whole way through, or it's like, oh, I've just had so much work the whole way through. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's you, Ben.
I do get a bit of work, yeah.
Ben walks into our studio at the end of last year, cheery as, while me and Johnny are depressed, with no work coming in the door, flouting how much work he's got. We're like, oh, man, thanks.
Oh, yeah, that was, that was a bit rough on my part.
Read the room, Ben. Read the room.
Hey, your office is so nice, you know. You had to pay for that somehow. I just figured you were bombarded with work at the moment.
It's all about outward appearances.
Yeah. I quite like bring that more sort of collaborative community sort of vibe to things, because it kind of does make it more enjoyable and more exciting. Like,
yeah,
I shared my workshop and office with Connor for a long time before it got a little bit too egg spinny for him. When you're out here by yourself blasting away, like there's only so many conversations you can have with yourself. So
yeah. And I mean, we shared an office last year, and it was awesome having that collaborative sort of environment. And we share an office now with a builder, Ben Nansett from MPB Builders. And it's awesome having, you know, somebody on both sides of the coin of the construction process in the same room. We can just share so much information, and you can already see how much it streamlines projects on both of our sides. It's great.
Yeah, the shared learning, everything. Something else I kind of want to like implement into the culture, I guess, of New Zealand architecture is just like telling people when they do awesome work. Like, I think people kind of hold off with their praise a little bit.
And yeah.
I come from a culture of like skating and kayaking or something, where somebody does a cool waterfall flip that you like, you'll rally flip behind and you share the stoke. So I don't know. I really want to bring that kind of vibe to architecture. Of like,
it's just because you're alone out there, mate. So you got no one to prop you up.
Yeah.
that's an interesting take, Gerard, because you're right. I think our industry is almost, it's too focused on criticism to a degree, and there's not a lot of industry, like internal industry props, and there should be way more of it. I mean, like there's obviously the awards processes and things, and everyone sort of rallies behind that, but there's also a little bit of animosity around that, because you know people are like, oh, like, I didn't win, I should have won, why did that one win, blah 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 blah, whereas really everyone should just be out there getting hyped for each other. And even though it's a competitive industry and a competitive field, and there's lots of us, actually we're all here with one goal, and that's the betterment of the built environment. So why aren't we all supporting each other?
Also, I guess like to kind of counteract that, there actually isn't. I don't actually think that there are too many architects in this country, and there is some epic architecture. There's a lot of amazing architects. They do some awesome stuff. Like every year, looking at the NZIA awards, man, I'm just like blown away at the level of architecture that we're actually producing. But there is also so much more rubbish. You know, there's so much more rubbish. So I don't know.
But like, that's it, right? Like, what are we? What are we? 10% of the built environment in terms of bespoke design, and it's concerning, right? Like, we've just built a place in Lake Harwear, and I've been down there for the last month. There's a new development in there going in there called Longview, and God, it's grim. Yeah. It's so disappointing.
That Longview is not so long anymore.
Man, you're talking about one of the most beautiful settings in the country. Stunning views, 360 degrees, and you've got these off the plan stucco houses being built in this environment, and they're so unsuitable for the terrain that they're in. They're so unsuitable for the environment that surrounds them, and you're just like, what's going on? But so many people are happy with that, and it's a tough one because it's almost on us as a profession to sort of push a better built environment, but it's difficult when there's, you know, a big block wall of genericism in front of us.
Yeah, and that's so interesting that your comment on there's so many people happy with that. When I was young and, you know, just sort of starting out in the profession, I remember giving a good friend of mine a lot of grief. She was just purchasing her first house, and it was kind of like a GJ Gardner type house. I think it was actually a GJ Gardner. And I was giving her a lot of grief about it, like, oh, you know, why aren't you getting an architecture house? But the reality is, like, who's going to buy an architecture house for their first house anyway? So, you know, the fact is, like, they do have their place. But, yeah, I don't know. It's just a tough one. It's a tough one. I think there should be a lot more architecturally, you know, design houses, but how do you do that? In competition with the GJ Gardner typology.
With the group homes, it's a tough one.
There are some good groups trying to, like, take on that market, and I kind of see them as, I don't know, the main competition. I don't really see architecture as competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. We should do a whole pod on taking on the
group home. It's us versus the world, you know?
taking on the group home.
Yeah.
Taking on the group home builders.
Yeah, it's a great pod.
Absolutely.
It's a lot better.
Yeah, nice. Like, what month's that? June.
Space makers, city makers. Like, I think there's a lot to offer that isn't getting offered, I think.
So anyway, Ben, what else did you want to cover today, mate? Should we?
Well, predictions for the year, maybe. How do you think this year is going to go? Maybe we just wrap it up with that. What are some key things in the architecture realm? Don't limit it to New Zealand, like internationally even, or even New Zealand.
Who's going first?
You go.
Sweet. I've actually had a good think about this and did a bit of research as well. And Dazeen dropped this interesting article, sort of their hot takes for 2024, their predictions. And a couple of them I agreed with, and I'll just dwell on those initially. I think the first one, which is close to my heart, is there's going to be a big uptake, hopefully. Well, I think there's going to be a big uptake, particularly in the both commercial and residential sector, of client and developer understanding of green building accreditation. And I think it's been in the industry for a long time, and a lot of people throw around these things like Living Building Challenge, Green Star, Home Star, Neighbours, whatever. Passive House.
Do you just want to give us a quick rundown on how that green building accreditation might work? Because for those
listeners, I mean, super briefly, I mean, because it's a pod in itself pretty much, but super briefly, there's a lot of organisations out there, both nationally in New Zealand and internationally, that have certain standards that must be met for a building to reach a certain accreditation. A lot of it is focused around sustainability and whether that be in the building's performance or in its construction. And these are things like carbon counting, understanding what your building's water and energy usage is. So that's things like solar, recycled water for commercial buildings, stuff like that. And then a big one, obviously, that everyone sort of throws around is the whole passive house idea, and that's thermal focus and energy consumption focus and things like that. So what I think one of the biggest shifts that we're going to find this year is the general public's understanding is going from, this is a cool buzzword, I pluck it out of the sky, and I say, I want this, but actually not understanding what it means. And I think that there'll become a greater understanding in the general public about what those accreditations are, and what that will lead to is an uptake in a desire for this, both residentially and commercially, which ultimately will just mean a better built environment. So,
well, how's that going to work in terms of, you know, the price of materials, for example? Do you think, you know, those costs are going to have to come down, or are buildings just going to be too unaffordable, too unattainable, you know, especially like from a developer perspective? It's hard to really make those feasibility studies stack up if your costs are too high.
I mean, yeah, for sure. But I think what a lot of it is it's not necessarily just like the cost of materials or necessarily the cost of labor. It's more actually the cost of your consultants, I'd say, is what will – the cost of your consultants is what will be the biggest sort of cost increase for developers and things within the realm of green building, because what you're going to need is you're going to need consultants, be they architects, service engineers, what have you, that understand how to design, how to maintain, and how to deliver these green buildings. And without that, you're just going to have a lot of people throwing money at it, at projects, and not actually getting something to work.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have these skilled designers, which are now starting to emerge, and you know, a lot of these sort of Homestar professional type accreditations and Green Star building designers and things, these people are starting to emerge far more skilled and experienced in the market now. And what they're able to do is deliver these projects cleverly, hopefully not influencing, you know, the end dollar too much. But obviously there'll be an increase in fees a little bit for our services. But what it's going to give you through the lifetime of the building is a far better performing, ultimately cheaper to maintain, and run building than what you're getting currently. Yeah. So
do you think, just adding to that, we're going to also see like an increase of educate like architects and that, right, going to green building, you know, the education. And
I think it's almost becoming a necessity, particularly I'd say for the residential sector. I think it's a necessity that the majority of residential architectural firms have either somebody in their team or access to somebody, whether that be a sub-consultant or something, that has this knowledge.
Yeah, interesting.
And, you know, there's murmurs about it's being included into the building code or the building consent process in the future, which I think would be excellent, but we'll just have to see and watch that space. So that's hot take one for me. And then hot take two is I think there will be a bit of a revolt, maybe not a revolt, but a moving away from AI and design. And this, you can call me out on this if you want, but I think everyone's, you know, it's only been a year or so since ChatGPT massively emerged on the scene, and I think it's had a big influence, even on our profession. But very quickly, there's become too heavy a reliance on what AI can provide. And I think this year we'll see a little bit of there's been a sharp upturn. I think what we'll see this year is a bit of a flattening of the curve and maybe even a bit of a downturn on the reliance on AI. That's
my take. You say that, but who's relying on AI at the moment? And especially in the architecture realm, like who's, you know, like I use ChatGPT all the time, but other than that, like I'm business as usual.
Yeah, for sure. But I think this is maybe not necessarily a New Zealand focused thing, but I think internationally lots of people are starting to lean into AI to generate concept designs, to produce a lot of that imagery. You know, even we will use render software, but then we'll use generative AI to build backgrounds and all that sort of stuff. You know, and it's great and it works well, but I think what it's doing is it's sort of taking away a little bit of that finesse and care and attention that like architectural projects need, which is why I think there'll be a bit of a revolt. But we'll see.
Yeah. It's definitely a slow burning, process, getting all of that software to actually be of any significant use. And also, we all know how slow the architecture construction industry is. So, people to adopt and start using them as like an everyday part of their process, I think that's going to be a slow burner as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. About like, you, Gerard? What you got?
It seems, in my mind, a hard thing for most architects to actually want to do, like want to use AI as a design tool. Like, I understand, like, the adding stuff to your renders to sort of soften it out and whatever.
I don't know, man. I think we're all looking for a shortcut a lot of the time, and this is why I think, like, maybe this is not necessarily a New Zealand take, but maybe potentially more international, is that we're always looking to speed up the process and, you know, be able to deliver things quicker, and that's what AI does.
Yeah, but it's only those monotonous tasks, so it's not like you can't take away the essence of architecture. Well, you can, but you want to avoid that at all costs.
But that's exactly it. And I think that's the risk, is that people have got too excited about AI too quickly and are losing that essence.
Yeah.
Which is why there'll be the revolt, is what I'm sort of leading
fair.
To.
Yeah.
Well, I missed the uptake. I haven't.
You'll catch it on the next wave, mate.
There's another set rolling through soon, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't even typed anything into ChatGPT.
Yeah. what do you have anyway, Gerard? You got something?
Oh, hot takes. I actively try to stay away from like looking at trends or forecasts or kind of anything. Call me old school. I like to stay in the dark so I can be less. It's wishful thinking, I guess, because we see so much day to day anyway, but it's kind of do it in the hope that hopefully you can come up with some original, interesting ideas.
Yeah, nice.
Uninfluenced. So, Gerard, your hot take of 2024 is to remain in the cave.
Yeah. I'm just going to keep chipping away, doing my thing.
And I like it.
One foot in front of the other. Got some projects on the go. So, and like a backlog of ideas I want to work through, so we'll do that. And like how you guys have gone overseas, I'm hoping I can get a little trip overseas this year and
get some influence.
Haven't been past Aussie, so it'd be nice to be influenced in that way. Like, I'm getting quite into sort of historical architecture. Like, I think the older you get, the more into history you become. I don't know about you guys, but I've found that.
Yeah, definitely.
Interesting.
So I kind of like these ideas. I've been playing with some ideas on sort of Gothic arches and stuff, like referencing some of that style of architecture, but in like a modernist sort of mid-century sort of way.
I prefer the classic. After living in Rome and Italy for 6 months, I definitely prefer the more kind of classic typology, but I'm 100% with you there.
Yeah.
Bring back the old school construction.
Yeah. Well, we're sort of toying with some of those classical ideas and that Hobsonville project, so we're already so
definitely.
It's interesting though, because although I don't think we've ever lost at least the classical concepts, you know, like form and order and all those sort of things, they're always there in architecture.
Yeah, I guess I'm meaning a little bit more literal, like using Gothic arches in like a modern way.
Yeah,
and like I quite like those the cloister buildings. It's like a big courtyard of archways. So like, I love courtyards, and lots of my projects seem to have courtyards in them. So maybe tying that into projects. And
cool.
Yeah, there's lots of ideas to work through. So that's kind of where I'm heading. I just continue to develop ideas and try work through them.
Yeah, all right. Nice.
Ben, hot take.
What about you, Ben?
Well, I guess mine would just be more of like an industry prediction. I think we hopefully, and take this like a grain of salt, but I think we're going to sort of start to slowly see a bit of a increase in work. I think
that'd be nice.
Interest rates will hopefully start to come down a little bit. OCRs seem to be stabilizing and inflation is slowly dropping off. So I think, yeah, we're going to see maybe not so much because the architecture is kind of always a little bit slow, but hopefully the property market picking up a little bit towards the mid or end of year and off the back of that work increasing, I guess, is probably my only my only prediction. Nothing architecture related directly, but that's kind of what I'm predicting for the year.
I hope you're right.
Yeah.
I think that's wishful thinking. No, I agree with you, Ben. It's interesting. Like, I think you can feel the murmurs of an improved market sector. You know, the construction market sector is definitely on the improve.
Yeah.
Having a chat to a couple of builders this week, and they're like, we're getting a lot more inquiries, particularly for like renovations and things like that as well. And
yeah, nice.
I think a lot of the time it's, you know, the tail wagging the dog, or vice versa, whatever that saying is, you know, and we'll follow. And I think, you know, obviously last year we went through a massive economic downturn, an election, all increased building costs, you know, increased interest rates, all of this sort of stuff. And so it was sort of this shitstorm of bad luck for the building sector. But, you know, we're through a lot of that now. And, you know, we're in that lingering post Christmas, New Year, holiday period churn of no one's quite sure what they're doing yet. Come March, I think there'll be a far more clear direction. Time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, well, let's wrap it up there. That's the pod.
The pod. Nice. Cheers, boys. Nah. It's been
Cheers.
Nice kickoff. I'll stop recording.